Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's show was brought to you by MolecularRecipes.com, the world's number one source for molecular gastronomy recipes, techniques, ingredients, and tools.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live. What is that?
What is that? I like it though. What is that?
Cheese. That's a nice cheese theme.
It's a good cheese song, right?
Yeah. Is that yours? Whose is that?
No, it's this. We do Cutting the Curd, and every once a month we do a book review with Diane Stemple, and that's her theme song that her friend made for her.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit more cheese. Yeah,
that was it, but we can start it from the beginning.
Yeah,
here.
Let's go from the beginning, because I was... That's very, like, early 80s, like, you know.
It's like Talking Heads. It's
early 80s, like, the cheese is, like, never, like, on the same beat. It's never on the one. It's never, you know, it's just cheese. It's cheese. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Cheese. Call your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Coming to you on the Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, right? Joined as usual in the studio with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez, and in the engineering booth with Jack Inslee and Wyatt. How you guys doing?
We are good.
Yeah, and we got a special guest in the radio studio today. I want to introduce you. Oh, getting a little buzz there on the phones, Jack. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
Sure, I'm Corey from Little Bird Chocolates, and we make Fire Bites, which are chocolate covered candied jalapenos.
Nice, and they're a supporter of the museum. They gave, had their stuff in the gift bag at our, what's it called? What's that thing called?
Puffing Gun?
No. It wasn't the Puffing Gun. It was the, our main event. It's the main benefit that we do every year. That thing's coming up when? In May?
Don't know.
What is it, May?
I don't know. I really don't know.
I think it's in May. I'm not sure, though. You'll be hearing about it. Peter.
I think he's coming.
Today?
Again, yes.
Yeah, well, Peter Kim from the Museum of Food and Drink will come on and we'll talk about that. So why don't you explain what you got here?
Sure. So we have our most popular treat is a dark chocolate-covered fire bite, candied jalapeno covered in dark chocolate with just a touch of sea salt. We do them in dark chocolate, milk chocolate, white chocolate, and then we have a fire bark where we take the jalapenos, we grind them down, add it to the chocolate and with a touch of sea salt. So it's just a little consistency different, and the heat hits you differently on that one.
Yeah. All right, let's go dark. I mean, let's break open the dark.
Try
it. Rest us. And does the milk soften it a little bit, or no? Within the milk, or no?
You would think, but it actually, I think the most popular or the spiciest is actually the white chocolate, which is sort of counterintuitive. You'd think it's just sweet, and the cocoa butter sort of coats your tongue and doesn't let the heat go.
Hmm. Write that. Doesn't let the heat go. Write that down. That's a. Is that an album or a song?
Doesn't let the heat go.
Yeah,
sounds like more of a song.
Well, the last band name that Stas and I had that we were gonna. And it's kicking in now. The last band name that Stas and I were gonna do was Secretly Awesome. Mm-hmm. Remember that? Mm-hmm. What was the album we were gonna have on that?
I don't. Mother's Second.
What?
It was like Mother's Second Family or something.
Oh, Second Family.
Second Family.
Second Family by Secretly Awesome. That was our, yeah, yeah. But, you know, what was the song we just came up with, though?
Don't remember.
We just had a song name like 3 minutes ago. Oh, my God. Someday we'll write this down.
I got a song name.
What do you got?
Caller on line one.
Ooh. All right. Let me try some white chocolate while I listen to the question from caller one. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing? It's Antoine from Boca Raton, Florida.
How you doing? How's the weather down there in Florida?
It's actually better than what you guys have right now.
Well, it wouldn't be hard. Yeah, at least we're not in Boston, huh? Boom! Boom, Boston! Take that. Like, what are they in? Like 18 feet of snow or some crazy thing over there?
No.
Crazy. All right. So what do you got for us?
This is the few times where Boca's actually nice. We're enjoying it.
Nice. What do you got for us?
Yeah, I have two questions. My first one's a little simpler. I'm doing essential oils inside of water. I wanted to make like a citrus water. The only problem is that the oils always separate. And so I was going to use either polysorbate to help find a way to emulsify it, but I wanted it to be water. Or I was going to perhaps freeze it and then have the oil separate at the top. I just want to know if you had any recommendations for that one. And I had another question.
What's the final application? What's going on?
I just want to make carbonated citrus water, essentially.
Oh yeah.
With essential oils, but the essential oil always rises to the top and separates.
Yeah. So what you need is gum arabic.
Gum arabic.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be shelf stable, right? It just has to be stable for a little bit of time.
You know, a few days or so.
Hmm. Okay. So gum arabic is what people typically use for this. I mean, when you're doing citrus oils, everyone used to use what's called brominated vegetable oil. And what it is it's an oil that you mix people don't use it anymore, but it's you mix it with the citrus oils and it averages the density out because the brominated oil is heavier than water and the citrus oil is lighter than water. And when you add them together, they try to get the density relatively similar to the finished beverage. And this way, when you add like their emulsifier, and the reason they use arabic is because it's a decent emulsifier. It also doesn't increase the viscosity very much, and it also dilutes quite well, which means that it doesn't mess up carbonated beverages. So you know, you would use like an arabic and a brominated vegetable oil. They have a replacement now for brominated vegetable oil because I don't know whether it's actually bad for you or whether it's theoretically bad for you. I don't know. But by the way, I've just like rounded into a nice like mellow like constant heat in the back of my mouth due to the jalapeno. Anyway, so you could try an arabic the problem with the stuff that I use typically for emulsifying is it has like a bodying agent in it like xanthan, and that's going to be a nightmare when you carbonate, complete nightmare. So you could try arabic. I had just recently looked up what to use in place of brominated vegetable oil, but I forget what it was. But, you know, arabic by itself should be able to keep it for at least a little while. And then you might have to shake it back together. But you might want to give that a shot.
What about the application of polysorbate?
Like the regular, like 80 or 60. I don't really know. I've never really used that stuff in a beverage application. I don't know. What would be the why would you use that instead of like an arabic or something?
I don't know. That's just initially what I was thinking. I just wanted to emulsify it. Didn't want to have any taste.
Right. Have you
emulsifier?
Yeah, well, remember, like, you know, you want to get like a fairly, you know, a nice clean arabic, not like, you know, the ones in rocks. Get the powdered stuff that's meant for food grade. That stuff is good. But did someone else like somewhere publish a recipe using one of the polysorbates, like 60 or 80 in this kind of an application? Because I wouldn't like jump at something like that right away for this app.
No, I was just doing my own research, and that was something that I kind of fell onto.
Yeah, I would check out Arabic. Like, arabic is the classic, like, soda system. It's, like, really clean in terms of
people don't have bad feelings about it, except for, you know, the possibility that if you're sourcing it improperly, you're supporting terror. But, you know, as an actual product, they don't have bad feelings about it. And I think the terror Arabic might be over. Like, I think the gum acacia, like, you know, sourced from murderers might be a thing of, like, more like 10 years ago as opposed to now. Although I'm saying that, and I don't know. But my feeling is that I haven't had anyone call me a supporter of murder recently for using gum Arabic. But, you know, it probably merits more research. But I would look at that first and see what's happening. And then I would look up on the internet brominated vegetable oil, or BVOs. I would look up BVO replacements. And all the big folks like Pepsi and Coke and those guys are shifting away from using BVOs in – and classically they would be found in things like – in cloudy carbonated drinks. So Sunkist or Mountain Dew, you know, which is kind of – you know, when Moses came down, one of the things that, you know, he brought was Mountain Dew. That stuff is, you know. We've had actually a lot of Mountain Dew questions on this, on the air. Like, Mountain Dew, do you like Mountain Dew, Jack?
Sorry, late to the mic here. You know, I did when I was, like, in junior high, maybe.
Junior high?
Yeah.
You were a caffeine pushing early, my friend.
Early, yeah. But I don't think I've had a Mountain Dew in probably over a decade.
I'm pretty sure that I would not have made it through college without Diet Mountain Dew. Case after case. Every spring, I used to drive from Connecticut to Sarasota, like, and I wouldn't stop. So that's about 24 hours, you know, with 20-year-old driving. It's about 24 hours. And it was just, a bunch of boxes of pretzels, cases of Diet Dew, and Easy Cheese. And that's what got you down. And you leveled yourself out. Strangely, prunes also in the car. Now, you'd think that this would be a mistake. You'd think this would be a mistake. But with the sitting and all of the pretzels and Easy Cheese, you're so clogged up that to even feel regular, the prunes actually help level you out. It's kind of like, you know, a multi-system. So that would be the thing. We would just load the back of the car up with the diet cases of Diet Dew, and that was it. Just go. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Man, good times. All right, what was your second question? But I got to hurry because I got a billion questions from last week that they're going to kill me if I don't get to.
Sure. No problem. I have a friend that's really into the whole bone broth right now. I'm not really into it at all.
The whole what?
She wants the bone broth.
Oh, I mean, okay. Go ahead.
And she just wants to make, like, a beef one, and I'm kind of bored with it. But what I wanted to do was add a froth to it so I could make it somewhat like a cappuccino. She has them in the morning. So the only stipulation is that it has to be beef gelatin, and then I don't know what percentages of gelatin, fat, and liquid to put in there to make a sort of broth for the cappuccino on that.
Wait, so a cappuccino textured froth?
Yes.
Right, with like an emulsified cloudy broth situation.
Yes.
Huh. So... Well, let me think here. So, how would I do that?
Like, and I was thinking of perhaps making the broth independently and then getting an ISI and filling it with some percentage of fat, gelatin, and then maybe some of the stock, and then putting that froth on there.
Yeah, I mean, that'll definitely work. Or you could, you know, you could make a fluid gel out of the stock, like, you know, and then just, you know, add hot some like emulsified fat and spray the thing out, and it'll stay forever, you know, basically. You know, if you do like a gel and fluid gel, it'll just stay and stay and stay and stay. Or you could whip it, but I'm trying to remember like what I would do to. I mean, you don't have a homogenizer. We can't make like a cream out of it. I mean, like any one of those tactics would work. I mean, I would just go. I'm sure you know Kaimos has ripped somebody's recipe for like foam, you know, some sort of like beef fat foam, and then used it. Or you know, you could make a really hyper. If it has to be beef fat, that's one thing. But, like, the easiest thing would just be to go with butter fat. Like, use a cream and then do – reinforce a cream with a very, very concentrated beef stock. you know, super concentrated bee stock reinforced cream. And if you get the temperature of that right, the problem is if you heat any of those things, you're going to break them down. So, I mean, I'm assuming if you want like a cold foam. If you want a hot foam, I would definitely move to something more that would stabilize with something that's not going to melt out when it gets hot, right? So you're not going to do a hot foam with cream base. You're not going to do a hot foam with a beef fat base unless it's stabilized with something that's, you know, you're not going to use the beef fat as a stabilizer is what I'm trying to say at a hot temperature. And you're talking hot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you're definitely going to want to go to something like a fluid gel, or because you want something denser, right? You don't want it like that light, airy kind of like lecithin-y stuff, right? You want more of a hardcore.
Yeah, I want like a froth, pretty much, like something that will sit on it for a while and then, you know, perhaps dissipate in the way that a cappuccino eventually does.
Yeah. So I would use you can add a lot of gelatin as a bodying agent and then like take a hardcore like fluid gel and put it in as a stabilizer. Just get the flavor where you want it. And you could probably add the melted beef fat to it and whisk it together. It'll probably stay and then foam up. It'll probably last, I would guess. But like having not actually done that application myself, because as you know, I have stayed away from foam toppings in general in my own practice, just, you know, other than when I teach hydrocolloid classes. But, you know, that was years ago because it's just, you know, I stay away from it just because, you know, I've had so many dealings with it. But that should work.
Okay, cool. And about what percentage would you use the gel in?
Oh, well, if you're going to use gelatin, you might get a weird reaction. It's not, actually, you know, you won't. Gelatin and gelatin work great together. That's how Wiley's deep-fried mayonnaise and works. But, I mean, you don't need a lot of, you know, you can get a really, really, it depends on how stiff you want your fluid gel and how much you're going to add liquid back to it. So if you're going to add a lot of liquid back to it, so you need a relatively stiff fluid gel, then you're going to go high. And by high, I mean like 0.5%, which is really high. You know, if it's going to be the whole thing is going to be a fluid gel on its own, then you could go down to like, you know, 0.25% or something like this. But, you know, go start high, start like at like 0.5%, or if you're going to add a lot of liquid to it, even higher, like, you know, 0.8% or something like that. And then when you dope it back, it'll be, also agar will work nicely if it's not going to be too hot and it's easier. But agar might have some weird reactions with gel. Agar and gelatin, especially if the gelatin is really concentrated or break down, can have weird reactions where you get little like grittiness to it, which is unpleasant. So then, you know, in that case, you want to use the gel in.
Excellent. Thank you very much, man.
All right. Good luck. Let us know how it works.
Warm up there.
All righty.
So, Dave, I have one more caller that's been patiently waiting.
All right. All righty. Here we go. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, Dave. This is Scott from Florida. I had a question. I'm curious about your opinions on any of the circulators under the $400 range. There's a ton of them out there now. I just can't justify doing like the $800, you know, polyscience just because of, you know, $800. But I'm not in a position to make my own, but there's a ton of them out there that are like under $400. I even looked at like the newer polyscience ones that they label for home use. The problem is that some of them are under like 750 watts. So I don't even think that would be worth considering. Do you have an opinion on any of those?
Well, what are the wattages? I mean, most of the, I mean, the old school polyscience, right, is a 1,000 watts of heating, right? That's right. Yeah, 1,000 watts of heating. And which ones are under 750 watts?
I think they've got a new one now that they're marketing like for home people. It's like a funky yellow color. I think it's Creative Series or Discovery. I have no idea.
No.
One of those two. But it was like 750 watts, and every one of their other ones was 1,000 watts. Like the Nomico was, you know, 1,000, so was the Anova. All that stuff for like home use, most of them were over 1,000 watts.
Yeah. So, well, you got to remember, there's two ratings you have to look at. There's how many watts is the full unit. In other words, how much is it going to suck out of your wall? And then what's the actual wattage of the heating element? And it's the wattage of the heating element because they're all basically the same heating style of element. So, like, you're not going to get one that's drastically more efficient than another, so you don't really have to worry about it. You can pretty much match watts with watts. It's not like trying to compare, an induction stove to a resistive element stove where it's, you know, range, rather, where it's like, you know, you can't compare them. So, the, you know, a lower wattage unit is just going to start sucking wind when you start doing more products. So the question you have to ask yourself is, if you know right now that you're never going to cook more than 30 eggs at a time, you know, then you can go with a lower wattage. If you know that you're never going to, you know, cook a full Lexan's worth of stuff, yeah, maybe you can go with a lower wattage. I mean, for me, I like having the full 1,000 watts. In fact, like, you know, I would often wish for more power because I usually push things to the edge of their envelope. Now, when it comes to, you know, spending the money, like, the truth is that, you know, in a lot of ways, my favorite is still the old metal one just because they're so tough. And then my second favorite is probably the $800 plastic one, which has a lot of advantages, like smaller in the bath space. I've used two or three of the newer style of ones, including PolySciences. I've used the Nomiku. I've used the Sansair, and I've used the Anova. Which one do you have, Peter? Which one do you have?
The circulator?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the one that was on Kickstarter.
It's like half the Kickstarter. That's how, anyway.
They've all been on Kickstarter.
Yeah. Useless information. Peter came from the museum, just showed up with some useless information. Anyway, so I've used them all, and the good news is that they all pretty much hold the temperature. So they're all a valid way to start using these techniques at home. You know, where you lose in some of the things is kind of like the fit and finish. So for $200, it's very hard to make something that's going to be as robust as an $800 one. You know what I mean? So it's just more apt to break apart. And some of the cheaper ones actually have like fairly nice interfaces, but sometimes they're a little more touchy, or like parts will fall off of them while you're using them, or they don't like pushing oil as opposed to water, you know? So, but these are all specialist kind of things. And so I would think that, I would look at the specs on the lower wattage ones. I would get like an advantage. So a lower wattage one, if it's a smaller profile, actually might not be as much of a disadvantage because it takes up a lot less space in the container where you're circulating. So a lot of people don't think about the fact that a larger circulator that takes up more space in the pot needs a fundamentally larger vessel to cook in. And so you need more power because you're dealing with a larger bucket of water. Whereas if you can get away with a smaller bucket of water because you have a smaller profile thing, then maybe you don't need as much power. So these are all kind of things to look at. But in terms of the actual like PID algorithm, there are slight differences between different people's PID algorithms, but they all freaking pretty much work. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Gotta turn it down.
No, I appreciate it.
Yeah, all right. Well, let us know. Getting some fuzz on here, but let us know which one you chose and whether you liked it. I like hearing feedback from people. You know, don't I? Right. All right.
Yeah, they're supposed to have a newer one for the Nomiku that's Wi-Fi, but I don't really care about that. But it was like over 1,200 watts for the heating element, so that was what I was looking at.
All right, we're getting a lot. It's hard for me. I haven't seen the new Nomiku that's Wi-Fi, but like I'm considering turning my entire house to Wi-Fi so that when my router goes down, I can no longer turn on the lights. I'm actually petrified about this. You guys know about these like light systems for your house? It's like you have these light systems like Hue where you can like I could like look at my house right now and be like, you know what? I want my dog to be bathed in a soothing purple light. And I could like make a soothing purple light like and look at it on my phone and see
on
whether my
phone,
dog is
right?
grooving. On my phone.
Yeah.
And see whether my dog's grooving. But what happens when you have a problem with your router? Right?
You gotta go manual, I guess, then.
Yeah, but like people are going switchless. Like they're not even having switch plates on the wall anymore.
No, that's crazy.
Yeah. Because
I had it in the last apartment I was in, but it's like if it wasn't working on the phone, you could just go turn it on.
Well, so like some of the systems like are more just like augmented with phone and Wi-Fi, and some of them are literally intended for you to turn your switches on and off on a regular basis with your phone. Because let's face it, like half the people you know are buried in their freaking phones all day anyway, so they might as well control their bowel movements from their phones. You know what I mean? Because that's how unseparated they are from it. But you know, like what happens if that goes down? It's like, you know, that's like, the story I like to say that, when they came, the cable guys came right before, what was the hurricane that hosed us? Sandy. When Sandy came through, like a week beforehand, they were like, we're giving you an internet phone. It's going to be better than your real honest to God wire phone. Nope. Because it's not redundant anymore. Like, you know, whatever. I don't know. I'm considering buying these systems, but they just make me nervous because I'm an old geezer. What'd you say?
Oh, there's a new caller.
Oh, okay. All right. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, I actually need to take the answer off the air because I'm like right in a meeting right now, actually. Uh-huh. But I was wondering if you're familiar with the Modbar Pour River module. It heats water to like a really specific temperature.
Is it similar to like the heating system like on a Clover, but just more in a pour over situation?
Yeah, it's got a boiler, and it just pumps from the boiler. It gets the water to a super specific temperature and then pumps out. I was looking for an alternate method to do that, but like not an InstaHot, because what I've read is that InstaHots generally suck and they break and they're awful.
How many cups do you need to make at once, and how much time are you willing to wait for the cup to happen?
Well, I would like it to be on demand and an endless supply from a cold line. I don't want it to come from a hot line.
Yeah, I mean, so most of the problems with temperature control is very similar no matter what style of coffee you're making. It's very similar problems, right? So, I mean, the only problem that you don't have is the problem of pressure regulation. And, you know, the only problem that you do have that I wouldn't have is if you want some sort of agitation while you're working, if you want that to be, or if you believe in, like, the super fancy swirl patterns and all this other stuff of how you add the liquids, right? But in terms of control of the water itself, right? So I'm not talking about the delivery, but in terms of just the temperature of the water, like that, you know, you could do for not very much. You want to build one yourself?
What's that?
You want to build one yourself?
Yeah, I want to do a DIY kit. And actually, I'll have to listen to a podcast because I have to go. But thanks in advance.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so I'll just talk for a minute as though you were still on the air. So the this kind of temperature control is fairly simple. So I'll just talk about it in terms of how you would go about controlling something where I can picture it in my head exactly, which is, you know, the classic, I know it's espresso, but the techniques are the same, right? Is like the Silvia, right? So the Silvia is the classic espresso machine that everybody mods out because, you know, it's doesn't have a lot of parts. It doesn't have really electronics so much. It's like all like wired. It's very easy to break into and mess around with. It's all open. There's lots of space on the inside, and it works relatively well. It's high quality, right? So the first thing you do is you want to take whatever source of large amount of water that you have, and you're going to want to temperature control that, right? Bang. So that is very easy. You're just going to get now I'm assuming you don't want to do anything fancy. You're not going to move to microprocessor control. If you're going to move to microprocessor control, it's a whole different thing. I might use a different set of systems to do it because depending on what microprocessor you use, you have to buy a lot of stuff if you want to, let's say, integrate thermocouples into it because they have to go through a thermocouple amplifier before they go into your microprocessor, right? As opposed to some other systems which are a lot easier. You can buy sensors fundamentally that just plug directly into many microprocessor systems so that you don't have to do a lot of like interfacing or programming or anything like this. And there's billions of people online who have done coffee systems that are microprocessor-based. But I'm just going to assume that you're not microprocessor right now. So you're just going to get a very simple PID controller from, you know, it depends on how much you want to spend, you know, how kind of like, you know, nice or fancy they are. But you can get one for like $30 now. Thermocouple, very cheap. And you're not dealing with high pressure, so it's not a problem. And you just want to control the temperature of the vessel where the water is stored, insulate the hell out of it, have the heater at the bottom. It'll form a convective thingamacrap so that you're not going to have a problem with having too much of a temperature gradation throughout the thing so long as you're not radiating too much heat out of the top. And you don't really need to get rid of a lot of heat to regulate your temperature because you're going to be pumping cold water into it when you're taking this stuff out. Now, here's the deal. The larger the volume of water that you keep warm, the longer it will take to get it warm at the beginning, but the less temperature fluctuation you have when you put water into it. Now, you have two ways you can do this. You can take the hot water out, then pump water in. Right? And if you do it that way, then you have to wait each time you're going to make the coffee for the temperature to get back to where it was, but you're not going to have a temperature drop during the pump out. The other solution is to take and put to wrap a heater around a pipe or to get an internal, like you can get what's called a cartridge heater that is like the screws in like a pipe style, or you can do it with a compression thing and actually put it in line with the liquid. So you'd have two T's, the water would go through the tee, pass over the cartridge heater and in. Then you'd put a thermocouple on that, and you'd use bang-bang, meaning on-off. So what happens is you'd set it to whatever the temperature, slightly above the temperature of what you want it to be is, and then it would just – you have a hysteresis in it, like a regular old thermostat. The idea here is you just want to get the water within about 1 or 2 degrees of what you're going to want to use. And so if you wanted to do that and get a zero temperature drop, in espresso you're looking at pulling – you need roughly 600 watts of power to because we're pulling like a couple of ounces in 30 seconds, let's say. And so like it's around 600 watts of power is what you need on the bang-bang side of it to make sure that the water is not going to drop too much. Then the other thing is you might have to warm up your delivery mechanism, but usually these are done with very, very low wattage heaters. So in an espresso, you'd be heating the group with a very low wattage heater, like on the order of less than 100 watts, you know, and that, you know, you'd also probably do PID. I don't know what you would heat in your system, but you might have some sort of mechanism that you need to heat, and you're not going to want to design some complicated thermosiphon so that the boiler keeps it at exactly the temperature that you want. You're just not going to do that. So and then you're going to need the solenoids. I can talk more about it next time if you want, but is this making sense? Is this making sense about what you need to do? And I'm assuming that if anyone's going to do this project that you know what PID means. All right. So let me rip through some of these questions because I haven't gotten any questions. Do I need to take a break, Jack?
Today's break song is by Knife Show.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's me, Jack, as in Jack from Cooking Issues, as in the guy that's probably been talking on this show. So, here on the break to tell you about MolecularRecipes.com, which is not only an awesome website and store and resource, but also they support us, which makes them even that much cooler. So I know Dave gives you plenty and plenty of information on the show, but should you need further resource, should you want to get some of the things he's talking about, MolecularRecipes.com has recipes, techniques, ingredients, tools, all in the world of this modernist thing we love so much on the show. So, you know, explore the world of foams and spheres and invisible foods and mind-blowing cocktails, all that awesome stuff. There's a community of over 400,000 chefs, scientists, and food lovers sharing their favorite recipes, tips, and tricks. Cool photos, tools, gadgets. Again, this is everything you'd be into, all in one place, MolecularRecipes.com. And just for being a listener of this show, you'll get 10% off any of their popular kits just by using the promo code HERITAGE at checkout. That's promo code HERITAGE. So again, check them out, MolecularRecipes.com. Tons of really awesome stuff there. Definitely right up your alley.
There's another caller waiting, but you can answer another question before her if you want. Phone lines are off the hook.
Right. But you know what? If you call in, I think you get precedence, no?
I think so, too.
You
I think
get
that's...
one question.
Caller, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
How you doing?
So I'm calling because I'm on a low FODMAP diet, which basically limits a lot of different sugars that humans don't digest that well. In fact, there's some evidence that all these people who are going crazy for gluten-free, who think they do well on a gluten-free diet, it's not the protein that's bothering them in wheat. It's actually the carbohydrate. It's the sugar. So I'm wondering, is there a way to get gluten, like pure gluten protein, that I can add to breads and things? Because I have no problem with the protein. I just have a problem with the sugar.
Yeah, 100%. Vital wheat gluten. But, I mean, remember, so, like, I used to buy that all the time. So back... I would do is I would buy whatever kind of flours I wanted, you know, in terms of taste, and then
sure.
I would just dope in gluten into it to up the protein content to the point where I would get the elasticity and texture that I wanted. So I used to do that, all the time. But it's been a long time. But I used to bake bread, you know. Every day, basically. And so I had like a lot of this stuff lying around, and I haven't for a long time. But yeah, I mean, I think most supermarkets might still carry it.
You can get cans of it on Amazon.
The Vital Wheat Gluten? I used to get it in a box.
Yeah.
But yeah, you get the Vital Wheat Gluten, and yeah, you can just go to town on that stuff. Now remember, you don't want to over-gluten your stuff either. But yeah, and it works well. I've used it many, many times.
So if I do that and then I want to make an alkaline, like, ramen-y noodle, it would work because the gluten would be there.
Right. So you would increase the texture. You won't get the yellowness from the gluten because the yellowness comes from colorless compounds in the flour itself that are that when they go alkaline, then they develop their characteristic yellow colors. So some people
so chewy as possible.
Chewy as possible. Yellow, not so much. Well, in other words, like, it's going to turn yellow if those things are there, and if it's not, then it's not. But chewy is definitely possible. Now, I've never tried to get – I mean, I'm sure that it's not like 100% like one for one, because like all systems are complicated. So I don't know that
sure.
– I don't know that if you were to, let's say, take cornstarch and gluten the hell out of it, whether it's going to have the right texture or not. I just don't know because there's other things going on, like the structure of the starch itself, yada, yada, yada. But the but the point is, you can give it a shot. But if you want it to go yellow – in fact, I had someone tweet me this the other day. Like, people add vitamin B2, which is riboflavin, because it's yellow. But I don't know how much to add or whether or not that's a good idea. But in reality, the yellow is more of a consumer marker. It's not an actual – I mean, it's not an actual quality indicator other than then and then the flour, you know. One thing to note is that on yellow alkaline noodles, there's two color components that are there, and that is the yellowness and also what's called brightness. And brightness has to do there's browning that takes place, or, you know, kind of darkening that takes place, and it typically takes place in high protein flours. So yellow alkaline noodles have some bite to them, but they're not necessarily done with super high gluten flour. The best color yellow alkaline noodles that don't have the darkening are typically done with kind of a medium strength of flour. So I wouldn't go you know, Magilla Gorilla on the gluten. I would just get it to where it would be kind of like a in the AP range of proteins, not like on the heavy bread side, and but not down on the pastry or cake side either.
Okay, cool. I will definitely give it a try. And the sugars are all water soluble but not fat soluble. So one very quick follow-up question: what is the best way to infuse oils with mushrooms, garlic, and onions, because I can't have any of them and I love them?
I would just do like you don't have a centrifuge. I would just cut them really fine and just do like old school. You like heated alliums or raw alliums?
I like both, but heated is fine.
Yeah, so if you like it heated, I would just heat it with it and then strain it. You get a lot out of that flavor, like old school.
Would you do it in low temp water bath, or would you just do it right on the stove, like saute?
I mean, it depends on what flavor profile you want. So, like, the chemistry of alliums is extremely complex, right? So the flavors are going to be different. Let's say you were to crush or grind the garlic first, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then put it – the trouble is that you're going to have trouble filtering it out. Like, you're going to have to use – don't use a coffee filter. It's going to take you forever. But if you use like a paper towel or something, you could probably get most of it out again. But crushing garlic or crushing onions and letting it sit for a minute before they get cooked out is going to give you a different flavor profile than if you slice them and do it or, you know, anything else. Mushrooms, I've never made a mushroom oil.
Because all I can buy is truffle oil, and that's like – such
yeah,
a bomb flavor-wise.
Yeah.
I'd rather have, you know, almost like a portobello.
But I mean, can you take a dried mushroom, soak it, and then throw the water away and have the mushroom? Does the stuff go away, or is it too intact in there? Like, can you leach enough of it out?
It's still too intact because it's the sugars that are inherent to the mushroom.
Right, but in other words, you can't leach it out of the mushroom and then eat the mushroom.
I could try. Maybe it would get enough of it out of it.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much it's going to – I don't want to, like, have you mess up your system. But I'm wondering, like, so if you take something that's dry that has a little bit of rupture or, you know, a little bit of disruption
right.
in it anyway, you do the soaking and you take the broth, which is what I use, you know, like, all the time. I mean, like, it's
sure. –
give it to someone to make risotto. Please don't throw it out. But then maybe the mushrooms that went afterwards when they're done, maybe they've leached enough of their – stuff out that they're okay for you. I don't know. I would ask. I don't know
if
there's a way to test it.
I mean, the worst that happens, I get a upset stomach. It's not like I'm going to get hives or go in anaphylactic or something. But
yeah
that's a really good idea to try.
Yeah, so then, yeah, you can have the porcinis after they've rehydrated, and then somebody else can have the, you know, you can make a mushroom dashi with it, or you can make a, you know, risotto. All of these things are delicious.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds very cool. Thank you very much for the ideas.
All right, thank you. And if anyone knows of making your own mushroom oil, tweet us in and let us know how it's done.
Break.
I can't think. He's going to add the
break. We're going to put that in later.
Yeah.
So we have like an 7-minute warning here. So
7 minutes. Wow, what a random warning. Seven minute warning. Jack's coming up with a new sport with a 7-minute warning.
That's right.
All right. Okay, we got two questions. All about both on the same thing. So I'm going to do them both at once. At least I get two questions done. Ready? This is David from Pittsburgh wrote in, and also with a similar question, 80 from the UK. So we'll read them both and then answer them both, right? Okay. So we got Dave, I love the show. You guys should have a TV show. Yeah, right. Right from yeah, whatever. I don't know. No one's going to give us a TV show, right? No one's going to give us a TV show.
There's been interest.
Yeah, interest this. You know what? Whatever. I don't have time to talk about it. So much bad cooking TV out there. Probably true. There's a lot of TV. Most TV is bad, period. Not just cooking TV. Most TV is bad. Most things are bad in the world. Most things in the world are low quality.
You have a lot of questions.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I am from Southwest Pennsylvania, and as you probably know, Scrapple is big in these parts. I do know that. I was wondering if you could talk about the high-end Scrapple you made reference to a couple of episodes back, and also if you could talk about the process of making different flavored dashis. I've been hearing a lot about bacon, apple, potato dashis, to name a few. Thanks so much, Dave from Pittsburgh. And then 80 from the UK wrote in with a similar question. Just caught up with episode 194. Oh, my God. What episode are we on now, Jack?
I have to check, man.
Is this 200?
No. It's close, though.
Okay. Can Dave please speak to and describe what his fancy version of Scrapple involved, and also haggis? And when will the Searsall with the new plate with the new plated back screens be available? Thanks for the show, and don't stop. Best 80 from the UK. Okay.
This is 197, by the way.
Woo! All right, 80. Searsall should be in stock when?
Next Monday.
Next Monday, hopefully in stock. Next Monday. And by the way, the steak decorators, they're shipping them in March. We're looking for a March ship date now because the manufacturer, I forced them to get certification of food grade for everything that they were doing in the steak decorator, and it took them a while to get their food grade certification in. So I apologize, but steak decorator shipping in mid-March. Right, Stas? Okay. Now, I'll answer the non-Scrapple / haggis related question that David had. If you could talk about the process of making different flavored dashis. So typically when someone says X, Y, or Z, like dashi, and it's not really – it's really dashi, right? The way we think about it here, you take your kombu, which is the kelp, the seaweed, giant kelp, and you heat it. I prefer to heat it not at boiling. Like a lot of people will just bring it up to the simmer and then let it go, let it sit for a while, pull it out. I prefer to keep it around 70 Celsius. I have a whole bunch of kombu tests that Nastasia hated. You hated those kombu tests because we were just tasting kombu dashi without any bonito in it at all, right? So she hated it. But anyway, we did extensive testing on this. You can go look on the old Cooking Issues thing if it hasn't been entirely taken over by Cialis. Some sort of Cialis salesperson from the former Soviet Union. But the So you take the kombu, you do whatever you're going to do with it, and then that pretty much is invariant. Everybody does the kombu. Then the question is, what are you going to add to it? So typically, if you are making standard dashi, you take the katsuobushi, which is the pieces of the bonito that have been cooked, molded, dried, smoked, cooked, molded, dried, smoked, and they turn into these like boards. These not boards, but they look like wood. They look like wood, and then you shave them into these delicious like bonito flakes, which are bonito flakes, and then you put them in and you soak it, and it gets that awesome kind of proteiny cook. It's like all of the – it's amazing. So I love this stuff. But if you don't eat that, then you could use mushrooms. We were talking about mushrooms before. That adds a lot because you're trying to add the different parts to get the super umami out of it, right? Or Dave Chang, who started making bacon, what he called bacon dashi a long time ago, was like, well, these fish are going to be fished out soon. So what if we use kind of pork products? And he actually made pork, like katsuobushi things that are cured in a very similar way. Or you could just use bacon because what you're really looking for is something meaty, savory, sometimes smoky, depending on how you're feeling about it, cured. The apple dashi that I've seen is really just a dashi that people have added apple to. It's like, dashi with apple in it, not like apple instead. I look for potato, and I think people are probably just doing potato and dashi, although I did see somebody actually fermented a potato. Anytime you're going to make a dashi and you're starting with a kombu thing, you want something else that has protein breakdown products in it, right? So think things like bonito flakes or like mushrooms or like I guess even, you know, anything that people say are like big umami bombs, probably even like a cheese rinds, Parmesan cheese rinds would be good, things like that. So it's just looking to get that savory thing in a quick way. So, you know, like a classic Japanese dashi stock, all the work is done beforehand, and then the dashi happens in a couple of minutes. Whereas in a Western stock, you know, they do fundamentally no work beforehand, and then they spend hours on the stock, right? That's fundamentally a different way of looking at it. Now, to scrapple and haggis, and this is going to be our last thing because they're going to get rid of us. So scrapple is, for those of you that don't know, is a cornmeal and buckwheat. A lot of people admit the buckwheat mush that is made by taking whatever crap you have when you butchered the animal. So the pluck, which is like kind of the heart, the lungs, the liver, and then plus some bones and other odds and ends and like scraps. And you boil that to make a very richly flavored stock that has, like, usually if you add a lot of bony stuff, a lot of gelatin in it and whatnot. You pull all the meat out after it's soft and rendered and falling off the bone, and you put all the meat, you rip it off the bones, you put it through a grinder, and then you add a mixture of cornmeal and buckwheat to the stock, and you stir it like you're making a polenta, cook it, throw the meat back into it, right? Form it into blocks, right? And then you take those blocks, you chill them, you cut them into slices, and then you fry them, right? And so now, depending on whether you are, you know, a city kid like me, you either have it in the morning with maple syrup on it, because I put maple syrup on every damn thing because that's who I am, but or not. Like, a lot of people are against the maple syrup, right? You know what I'm saying? A lot of people are against the maple syrup. I happen to like it, and I can do what I like. So now the question is, why don't people like this? Because people are stupid, right? So you have to move to a higher end version of it. You have to take away what people don't like about the scrapple, and to make a higher end version, here's a couple. You can also make it taste more refined. So here are the things. People don't like liver in their scrapple, as it turns out. So what you want to do is, like, reduce the amount of liver that you have in it, sometimes down to none. And it might not be as official anymore, but you're going to get a lot more people pounding a lot more of it if it doesn't have a heavy liver flavor in the mush. That's just one suggestion. Another thing is
quick.
Okay, the way I do it, like, to make a higher – also, I'm going to get killed by people from Pennsylvania, but if you go to a straight cornmeal and don't do the buckwheat, it won't taste traditional, but a lot more people who are used to loving Italian food are going to like it more, right? It's going to taste – or even, like, regular Southern food, because it's not going to have another intrusive, like, kind of taste or texture to it. So go to a straight cornmeal to work people into it to go higher. Also, make a stock first. Right, and then don't use that meat to add the meat to the thing. So add a flavorful meat, almost like whatever sausage base you want. Add that as your ground meat to the scrapple when it cooks out at the end, so it hasn't been cooked for a billion years like that. It's tenderized. And then make a stock in a pressure cooker beforehand with your scraps and bones, so that you're separating the problem of the stock preparation from the meat that's going into it. So that it makes it just a much kind of more refined. You can adjust the flavors more. You can get a nice texture out of everything. It's not like a big mess, and you can cut it. And then next time we'll talk about the haggis cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.